Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Caroline Crampton, web editor of the New Statesman, and each week we bring you an exciting mix of interviews, discussion and analysis. This week, George Eaton and Raphael Baer discuss the week in politics, including Ed Miliband's performance at Labour conference, as well as what the next week might hold for the Conservatives. Philip Morne and I discuss the end of Breaking Bad and ask why we seem to be unable to make TV like that in this country, and our film critic Ryan Gilby gives his verdict on Blue Jasmine, the new Woody Allen film. I'm here with Raphael Baer, our political editor, and George Eaton, the editor of our Staggers blog, to talk about the conference that's just been and the conference that's about to be. So we'll kick off with the Labour conference, which you've both just returned from. Raph, let's kick off with you. What did you think of how Ed Miliband's done this week?
I think he did quite well in the end, although everyone sort of knew he would. The stakes were very high, and he's proven in the past that when he really needs to, when his back is against the wall, politically speaking, he can come out fighting and give a good speech, which he did. And he needed, at the beginning of the conference, there was enormous anxiety about him personally. He gave an interview on the Mar show on the Sunday, on BBC Mar show, which came across as sort of awkward and a bit evasive, and it just seemed to express everything that was wrong with the Labour Party, sort of sense of malaise and uncertainty. It's not a massive thing, but it certainly helped him culturally to set the tone for a lot of people. And then suddenly, pretty suddenly, at the end, he comes out with a whole bunch of policies, real actual things that a Labour government would actually do that are indisputably big. Chiefly, obviously, this thing that everyone's talking about now, which is a freeze on energy prices. And no longer is it possible to say Labour doesn't have any policies. No longer is it possible to say Ed Miliband is weak or afraid of a fight. No longer is it possible to say, credibly, Ed Miliband doesn't know what he'd do if he got into government. So that's a win. Obviously, you know, one speech isn't going to turn everything around, but they're ahead still in the polls. And the most important thing for me, I think, is that Ed Miliband has demonstrated that he understands what it is about his sort of personal status and brand that is weak and has been failing, and has shown he's not going to duck that, and he is actually going to actively try to address that. And that, I think, will give a lot of people on the Labour side confidence.
That's very interesting. George, you wrote straight after the speech that this energy price policy that Raph mentioned is a trap, a political trap for the Tories. Why is that?
He's quite cleverly appropriated the device of a cap. British politics has become obsessed with capping things. Generally, the right, capping benefits, capping immigration. And these are sort of wedge issues that challenge the left. And when the left oppose them, the Tories can instantly say, you're soft on scroungers, you're soft on immigrants. What Miliband has done now is has created a policy that is seen by Conservatives as too left-wing, too reminiscent of 70s price controls to support, and therefore puts the Conservatives on the side of the energy companies. And if Labour can find similar mechanisms to apply to the other big cost of living issues, wages, train fares, and so on, then that may start to shift opinion in their favour. So I think the speech was significant in terms of revealing Labour's strategy for the election. The big question is whether all of this is enough to overcome the two problems, the two biggest problems that Labour has, which is that it's still not trusted to manage the economy, and that Ed Miliband is still not seen as a future prime minister, and his personal ratings are well below David Cameron, in fact, recently have been similar to those of Nick Clegg. I agree with Raf that it was significant that Miliband said, if you want to have the debate about leadership and character, bring it on. You know, Labour will win the election because of me, not in spite of me. I thought there was too little on economic responsibility in his speech, though. He mentioned the deficit only once. It seemed to leave all of that to Ed Balls, which I don't think Labour can afford to do, because if they are going to make ambitious and in some cases expensive promises on childcare and housing, the danger is that even if voters appear to be attracted to them, the Conservatives will persuade them otherwise, because they'll say, but Labour would have to spend lots of money to do this, they would have to borrow, and you know, this may look like a nice policy goodie, but if it wrecks the economy and we go back to the bad old days, then you'll be sorry.
I think another interesting omission was schools and education. The as I remember it, the most important thing he said on the subject was about the wraparound childcare, essentially, and having children stay at school for longer.
Breakfast clubs after school clubs,
which, as a parent of school-aged children, strikes me as a completely brilliant policy, and I love it, although it wasn't entirely clear how they were going to pay for it. But following on from what George said about his bit on fiscal responsibility was very brief, and the danger for Labour is it looks like they are sort of complaining around the margins of George Osborne's recovery, sort of ceding ownership of the big economic strategy to the Tories and offering sort of palliative care around the sides, rather than actually having their own very clear structural argument about an entirely different economy. And I don't think he quite nailed that one.
So next week, we have the Conservative Party conference in Manchester.
Yay,
off we go again. George, do we expect them to go big on this economic responsibility? It's their strong point at the moment.
I'm sure they will do that, but you can already see how they are pivoting towards living standards. The Lib Dems obviously had the announcement on free school meals. The Conservatives are going to probably say something about the marriage tax allowance, which is, of course, you know, discriminatory, and I would say probably
it just
bad
die,
politics
will it,
for them.
As a policy.
But it is an example of how they are trying to move into a narrative of post-austerity. So now growth's back. And actually, the fiscal reality is that the next autumn statement will be the first time probably since the election that the borrowing forecasts have improved. And Osborne is going to have more money to play with. And the question is he going to use that money to try and meet his original deficit targets, which he's now abandoned, or is he going to use it to spray pre-election goodies at the electorate?
Yeah, I think we know the answer to that.
The
interesting thing, I mean, I've been told, and this, in fairness, this might now have changed because of Ed's big energy gamble, and the Tories might feel they need something quickly to close that down, but I've been told that they are not going to use next week, to say, we have an answer to the cost of living crisis. They don't want to concede that it is a crisis, first of all.
And partially of their making.
Because it's their, the one they would be presiding over, because it's not something people were talking about in 2010, so they can't really call it Labour's cost of living crisis. So first of all, they don't want to do that. And second of all, what they want to do, they have a sort of a grid of cost of living friendly policies, which they will launch sort of one by one in the build-up to the autumn statement, the focus of which will be, we've brought back growth, now we're going to share it around in a nice kind of way. And that, so next week the Tory conference will be about essentially, you know, we're back on the road, and then that will, you know, establishing, in quotes, the record on which the Tories can fight, and then they'll start rolling out the cost of living stuff.
And this issue of personality and leadership, as you say, I mean, Ed did give a good speech. He did project a stronger and perhaps slightly more charismatic image than we've seen for him before, but it is an issue on which he consistently trails David Cameron. Is this something that Cameron's going to assert even harder?
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, he still polls much better than his party. And part of the problem for the Tories is that not enough of them realise that or accept that. And I think they'll still frame the next election as a presidential one, because Miliband says bring it on, but history suggests that the public, once they've made up their mind about the leader of the opposition, they very rarely change it. I think the most probably Miliband can hope is to try to slightly improve the situation to limit the damage. I still think it's ultimately the Labour brand that is the strongest point for them.
Yeah, the focus groups on Ed are, I understand, really pretty dismal. The Tories do have to be careful, though, because David Cameron's least attractive side is his, you know, what they call the kind of flashman element, this slightly braying, over-assertive, overconfident sort of bully image. And what's particularly toxic about that, other than the fact that it is just intrinsically unpleasant, is that that is something that UKIP voters really hate about him as well. And that in the magazine this week, I've written a long feature about UKIP. And what I've found in connection with that is that a lot of the people who are voting UKIP are ex-Tories. And the thing they basically don't like about the Tory party, yes, it's the modernisation and some of the policies and gay marriage and the environment and all sorts of things they think the Tories are getting wrong, or that David Cameron got wrong. But they personally despise David Cameron as a human being with such venom that actually Cameron's standing up and saying, let's make this all about me, I'm presidential and strong and I'm the macho man, and I'll slap down that, you know, knock-kneed softy Ed Miliband. It might work with some swing voters, but it could actually shore up the UKIP vote.
And as we've seen with the, I mean, you've done the kind of electoral analysis, both of you, that actually the Conservatives have got a much harder job, despite being the incumbents, that there is this kind of 35% strategy. If Labour can just cling on, everything will be okay.
Yeah, I think the one part of the calculation, although they will never admit it, part of the calculation behind Ed's speech on Tuesday, was that actually there are quite a lot of left-wing people who, not enough to kind of win 50% vote share, but there are enough people who will really like this stuff, ex-Lib Dems in particular, who if you can really lock them down and hold on to them and just sort of form a battle formation with those people, 35-36%, as you say, up to the polls, you've won. And even if it's not a terribly elegant victory, you sort of bundled the ball over the line, you know, they'll take a goal. You're going to have to bang it in from 40 yards out. They still win.
Yeah, I think one point that's still underappreciated is that it's very rare for parties to return to opposition at the first time of trying, because the voters kicked them out last time. It takes, you know, quite a shift for them to say just 4 or 5 years later, actually, we were wrong and we want to bring you back. And that's something that I think Miliband's strategists find very frustrating, that he's constantly compared to Blair. People say, oh, Blair was this far ahead, even Kinnock in 92. But of course, that was after Labour had been in opposition for a long time, after it had time to shake off some of the toxicity associated with defeats.
And George made a very good point to me. We were talking about this the other day and said something that I think was very important. The polling is much better now than it was. So people say, oh, hang on, Michael Foot had a lead of 15 points over Margaret Thatcher in 1982. And yeah, Neil Kinnock was a lead of 5 million over Margaret Thatcher in 1987 or whatever. And actually, I remember that the 1992 election when Kinnock lost. And apart from the news being, you know, John Major's the Prime Minister, a lot of people were saying, hang on, there's going to be a lot of soul searching among opinion poll firms, and the polling was all wrong. And so actually, it's very possible that a lot of what we're thinking now, looking at the polls, going, oh, but it'll all swing back to the Tories, the Labour lead is soft, some of this is actually in the price. They have modelled it and they have worked it out. Mm. And actually, there's an element now of the opinion polls, and what you see is what you'll get. And
like
Labour,
the
therefore,
election,
might actually win.
Like we saw with the American election,
yeah,
where
exactly.
There was, the media were trying to create this narrative of, oh, you know, it's so close, when days, even weeks before, you were able to say, no, Obama will win.
Yeah, that's the polls are saying what will happen, because there is a science to it.
Mm. Well, thanks very much, George and Raf. You'll be able to see more, read more from both of them over the next week from the Conservative Party conference on the New Statesman website. I'm joined by Philip Maughan, and we're going to talk about television and what's been happening in television in the last week or so. It's been quite an important week. We had the Emmys, the primetime Emmys in the US, in which the only British winner was screenwriter Abby Morgan for the second series of the BBC drama The Hour, which was actually cancelled about 6 months.
Yeah, I think there's an axe to grind
before,
here, isn't there?
There is very much.
You were setting up to ask me a question, but I think really you want me to ask you a question.
Well, I'm just going to answer the question anyway. the series that she won, I'd say America's sort of highest TV writing award. Is that fair?
I would say. Yeah, Emmys are TV. This is synonymous. Yeah.
It was, the BBC cancelled it, despite it obviously being great. And we've also, at the same time as all this sort of television recognition is going on, we're coming to the end of Breaking Bad, which I know you've been writing about an awful lot on the website and so on, which is this kind of, what would you call it? Feels almost operatic in its scale. this TV drama?
Well, it's the latest in the sort of latest addition to the new form of our time, the new artistic medium of our time, which is the long form TV drama, originally starting on cable and HBO and so on. Now this is produced by AMC, who also made Mad Men and Breaking Bad at the Emmys, won Best Drama or Outstanding Drama. I can't remember exactly what the title is. There are going to be a lot of people who will know a great deal about Breaking Bad already, so please forgive me. To set up the show is about a high school chemistry teacher played by Bryan Cranston, who most people will remember, if at all, as the father from Malcolm in the Middle.
Yep.
Bryan Cranston, who is really the centre of this programme, starts making crystal meth after he finds out that he has inoperable lung cancer in order to leave a sort of nest egg for his family. And he's really captivating. He's a really he's really electric sort of screen presence. There's a lot to the performance. Bryan Cranston clearly believes a great deal in Walter White, the name of his character. But he is slowly corrupted by his life of crime, unsurprisingly, some might say. The trajectory of the show is said to be Mr. Chips to Scarface. That's what Vince Gilligan, the showrunner, so-called showrunner, creator, director, kind of pitched to AMC in the first place. And we are really now at Scarface. I'm not going to, the spoiler thing has been a real nightmare for people on Twitter, online, and so on. So I'm not going to say...
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Too much about the specifics of what's gone in the last series.
It's the form, I think, that's interesting, though, right? This long form idea, the fact that we've come to the end of this huge cycle.
Yeah, and it's a moral journey. I mean, the show is very clever in the way that it sort of it paints the kind of inner life of Walter White. I mean, for a long, long time, he started committing, horrible crimes. It's probably not going to be a great leap for anyone even who hasn't seen the show to guess that, there are, violent acts involved. And we're constantly asking the question, is this permissible? Is he really still doing it for his family? That's what he constantly says. And he's still saying it now after so many hours of really electrifying bad behaviour. He's still saying, what I do for my family. That's what it is. And like I wrote in my blog last week, that really family is synonymous with his ego. I mean, it's about his empire. It's about creating something. He was, slighted in all sorts of ways in the first episode. We find out that in the first series, anyway, we find out that there was a really successful startup that he was a part of originally, which he was kind of kicked out of. They kind of moved on him and got him out of the business. So he's got a great deal of anxiety over that. He clearly was a great scientist and a great thinker, and he ended up, not earning enough money even to pay the bills. He was working part time in a car wash at the beginning, which later down the line they end up buying as a means of laundering money, which is a great way of using that. I mean, the last series, which is where we are now, and which is not actually what they won the Emmy for. It was series four that they won the Emmy for. So they'll still be in the running for it with this series next year. So it'll be interesting to see how that comes out. This series, I actually went against it at one point. I felt as though they were just trying to the writers were sort of inventing plot at such a rate that it was very hard to kind of really believe it. I mean, I know the story is quite unbelievable, but like there's something about the narrative pacing didn't quite sit for me. However, I felt like that was kind of padding, and now we're at the proper conclusion, and it is riveting.
Yeah. And then to contrast this with what's happening in UK television drama, where, I mean, obviously we don't have the same infrastructure, we don't have the same network arrangement, we're nowhere near like the same kind of country in that sense. We have BBC, for instance, in the sense that America doesn't. But people in this country, as is evidenced by their use of Netflix and Love Film and probably more illegal means to keep up with this kind of show, Breaking Bad and other big American cable shows, people love it. But we're not producing it. We're not making any of this. Instead, we're making, as I referenced at the beginning, we make fantastic dramas like The Hour, where we give a brilliant writer like Abby Morgan 6 episodes to try and capture as many millions of people as she can and if she can't do that, it gets cancelled. Mm. We're not giving writers a chance in the same way.
We're not, and I can't imagine the amount of hoops that Abby Morgan and her team will have had to jump through even to get that far. This is kind of the problem, is there's no... we're too conservative, frankly. We're a little bit too philistine and we're a little bit too conservative. I mean, it's our writers, directors and actors who are going over to America who are in all of these shows. So we definitely have the talent. And not least because the theatre scene is so strong in Britain. I think that is a really, a brilliant kind of playground
and
for nurturing talent.
As well, the second series of the show that she won the Writing Emmy for, it was billed when it first started as The British Mad Men. It's a drama set in the 50s and 60s, well, 60s particularly, in the BBC, in a sort of newsroom. It's got all the beautiful costumes. It's got the kind of frisson of the different morals and beginning of progressive attitudes to life and sort of social affairs and all this kind of thing. It's got all of that tension, but in 6 episodes, trying to encompass sort of race and gender and sexuality, and everything, you feel a bit like you're kind of being jerked around all over the place. Mm. Whereas in maybe 18 episodes, which is the kind of length you get in a series of Mad Men, you get a bit more space to explore these things.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, the shows that have come from Britain and done really well overseas, things like, say, Downton Abbey, which has just started last week or this week. These things, I think America looks slightly down their nose at them while enjoying them. They're quite frivolous. They're not things that are actually setting America on fire. They're just doing well because they're easily consumed and so on. I actually feel similarly about Sherlock and Doctor Who. I'm very sorry to all the people who love those programmes. I know there are a great deal of people who do, but they are not original. I think
the same bit.
They're reliable.
I like Sherlock very much, but I like it because I like the Sherlock Holmes story. Right. I've liked it in lots of other incarnations in different books and TV series and radio series and so on. And I think it's a very well-written addition to that canon. Mm. And similarly with Doctor Who, it's a canon. It's not a standalone piece of creativity. It's very enjoyable nonetheless. But your point about Downton Abbey is a very interesting one because I'm a kind of... I don't know what you call me. I loved Downton Abbey very, very much when it first started, and now I have no time for it whatsoever. It's completely degraded as a concept. I like period costume dramas. I like witty, well-written period costume dramas, which this was in its sort of first 3 or 4 episodes. And then the sort of pressures of, needing to feed the Daily Mail a line every week or something like that, or the fact that it did do well in America and thus needing, they felt they needed to exaggerate the class differences. Because Downton Abbey was at its best, as I think a lot of that kind of writing is, when it was melodrama of trivia, when it was the kind of people fainting down on the floor because someone had suggested that there was a difference between a weekday and a weekend. You know, that was the kind of thing that really made brilliant television. You know, it was almost satirising our conception of what the Edwardian era was like, well, for the aristocracy anyway. And that's all gone now. Now everything has to be a big problem and a big drama and has to have a big solution. So like in this episode just gone past, we had a kind of the social affairs moment where an old friend of the butler was found to be in a workhouse and had to be rescued from it, which actually was quite dull. And maybe in fact, the best moment of the episode was watching the new housekeeper, the housekeeper and the cook trying to get to grips with an electric mixer.
Right.
For the first time. Incredibly domestic, incredibly trivial, but both funny and moving at the same time. Because, you know, funny in the sense that she turns it on and it goes everywhere and the bowl splats all over the floor and breaks everywhere. But moving in the sense that the cook finally admits that the reason she's up at midnight trying to use this thing while everyone else in this massive house is asleep is because she's worried that if she doesn't, she'll lose her job.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a kind of affecting element to it as well. And that's, you know, there's not enough of that in it anymore. It's all the kind of big stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
And the plot kind of... I feel like in Britain we make tick box television. Mm. Has it got this moment? Has it got this kind of, like, or tick all the class kind of requirements, tick all this and that? And it's just risk. I mean, when the BBC has taken risks in the past, and Channel 4, you know, and a number of others, like, our biggest shows, our biggest exports, The Office set and its comedy, but, you know, these things were things that were had to fight to kind of get through, if you know what I mean. And it just doesn't feel daring to me most of the time, you know? I mean, it just, you know, you compare what's on a weeknight on there. I'm watching now Tremé, David Simon, who created The Wire's next show, which is set in New Orleans, and it's been going quietly terrible ratings most of the time. I don't know whether people just don't want to watch a show set in New Orleans. I really don't know what the problem is. It's utterly fantastic.
Mm.
I'd recommend it.
Yeah. Well, on that note, get watching.
I'm joined by our esteemed film critic, Ryan Gilby, to talk about Blue Jasmine, the latest film from Woody Allen. So, Ryan, you've reviewed the film in the magazine this week, and I think you maybe gave it a slightly harder ride than a lot of other critics. Is that because it's been so successful in America and elsewhere?
I think that there's this strange wave of Woody responses with Woody Allen films. It's a bit like how people used to react to REM albums. Anytime there was the slightest kind of upswing or you know, sign of improvement in quality, people would say, it's a return to form, it's a masterpiece, they're back to their old selves. And it's a little bit like that with Woody Allen. Anytime there's a kind of glimmer of the old sort of sparkle of his 70s and 80s work, then I think people tend to kind of jump on that and say, this is a masterpiece, you know, he's got it back at last. And there's certainly some really fantastic things in Blue Jasmine. Well, one particularly fantastic thing, which is Cate Blanchett's performance. But I still think that, you know, you can see the same old sort of dramatic devices and some of the old snobbery that he has about sort of working class characters and things like that. I wouldn't say that it's exactly kind of one of the greats, although as I say, it does have this fantastic performance at the centre of it.
And where does that come from? I know you've compared her to Blanche DuBois. Of course, she was playing, you know, that role with the Sydney Theatre Company in the last couple of years. Has she brought some of that streetcar kind of feel to this role? What is it about her performance?
Yeah, I mean, the plot itself is kind of loosely modelled on Streetcar Named Desire. So, you know, she's kind of fleeing this wreckage of a marriage where her husband's committed suicide and he was in disgrace and everything. And she's kind of on her uppers a bit and staying with her sister. So this is very much like kind of Blanche and Stella. And there's a Stanley Kowalski type figure played by Bobby Cannavale, who many people know from Boardwalk Empire. So the setup is very Streetcar, although there isn't that sort of sultriness, there isn't that sexual tension that you get in the play between Blanche and Stanley. So yeah, that's just basically kind of the bones of the play, really. I wouldn't say it's actually an adaptation. And she's much more, I mean, she's got that kind of, she's got the sort of mania and the frazzled nerves of Blanche DuBois, but it's a much more sort of internalised performance. It's not the kind of the flamboyance that you get really with Blanche. She spends a lot of the film, well, portions of the film, sort of talking to herself and drifting through memories. And one great thing about the film is that it has this kind of dual narrative structure where we're flitting between her old kind of privileged life in Manhattan and her new life kind of lodging with her sister in San Francisco in an apartment that she finds sort of too cramped for her needs.
Yeah, you say so. San Francisco is the setting of this film, and I think that's a first for a full feature from Allen. Like, California has always been a place that characters disappear to, or, you know, and LA has been satirised and so on. But how does he you know, what does he make of San Francisco?
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because Los Angeles was always the butt of jokes in previous Allen films, or characters had sold out if they'd gone to California. And here it's actually it's this great source of like vibrancy and colour. You know, I'm not sure exactly. It's hard to know how Allen himself feels about it, because you know, for instance, this apartment that I mentioned, where Jasmine goes to stay with her sister. You know, we're supposed to think it's quite sort of, you know, it's a huge step down for her, and it's actually, you know, not that nice, and she's slumming it kind of thing. But actually, it's really great. I mean, it's a sort of apartment that you'd love to live in. It's got this real kind of bohemian chic to it. So I'm not sure that his, you know, sometimes you think his compass isn't quite set right. The things that he thinks is kind of roughing it, the rest of us would consider luxury. But the locations look fantastic, and, you know, it's always odd to see the Golden Gate Bridge kind of running across the background in any of the shots. You know, it just doesn't feel very Woody Allen. So I think there was a real picture postcard quality to a lot of his European films. You know, he did Match Point in London, a couple of other films in London too. You know, he did Midnight in Paris, obviously in Paris, and To Rome with Love. But and there was a slight sense that it was just he was really just touring the tourist destinations. But here, you know, San Francisco really gives some extra sort of life to the film, I think.
Yeah, and he talked quite candidly about the fact that getting sort of tourism money was a big part of funding his most recent films.
Yeah.
So Woody Allen is always quite down on his own popularity. You know, he kind of gives off the impression that nobody really actually goes to see his films. But like looking at the kind of the commentary on the last few films, particularly since Midnight in Paris, it would feel as though he's kind of on a roll. Do you think that translates into, you know, bums on seats?
Yeah, it's hard to know with Allen because I mean, in the past, you know, there were points in his career where he was, you know, pretty much box office poison, and you know, with Match Point, I don't remember his name being even visible on the poster. I mean, part of that may be because it was a thriller, and that the idea of Woody Allen being on, you know, on the poster for a thriller would be off-putting to people. But I mean, there does seem to be some sort of you know, a new sort of wave of affection for him. I guess since Midnight in Paris did so well, you know, partly maybe because he was working with actors like Owen Wilson and Rachel McAdams, who had that box office pull. Partly because that film is just very sort of, you know, it goes down very easily and very simply. It's a very, very sweet, sort of, but superficial film. So yeah, I'm not really sure how audiences, I don't really have a sense of, you know, if younger audiences, say, you know, audiences in their 20s have any sort of sense of or loyalty to Woody Allen. It's hard to say, and as he himself has said, you know, he can never predict which ones are gonna hit and which ones are gonna flop. I mean, you know, famously he despises Manhattan, which is one of the films that most people who love him really cherish.
Well, we will see. We'll watch with interest and see how it does this weekend when it opens in the UK. Thanks for talking to us, Ryan.
Thanks, Phil.
Today's podcast was presented by me, Caroline Crampton, with Raphael Bear, George Eaton, Ryan Gilby and Philip Morn. It was produced by me, edited by Philip Morn, and our theme music is taken from Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. For more information and to subscribe to our podcast feed, visit newstatesman.com/podcast.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.